Today's reading is Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 45. And they were on the road, going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him, and spit on him, and flog him, and kill him. And after 3 days he will rise." And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Isn't it fantastic that we can look forward to the glory that's coming in heaven? It makes all the struggles of this world just pale in comparison, doesn't it? And in this passage, we see a really big moment for James and John, two of Jesus' closest friends, as they come up to Jesus and look to their glorious future with him in eternity. They've got the right focus in life, haven't they? Haven't they? Well, let's look more closely, because Jesus doesn't let James and John off lightly. They've got the wrong end of the stick, in a way. Because future glory may be great, but life following Jesus is by no means going to be easy. And Jesus wants James and John, and the rest of his disciples then, and us today, his disciples now, to understand that. So, backtracking a bit, let's look at Jesus and what he says is going to happen to him. First thing that we want to see is Jesus is going to die. That's point one. Jesus is going to die. We're jumping in at a strange point in Mark's Gospel, sort of in the middle of a section. There's a kind of turning point in chapter 8 as Peter says to Jesus, "You are the Messiah." But then Jesus says he's going to be killed, and the disciples are a little surprised by that. Their ideas about who he is and what he's going to do are a bit skewed. So Jesus keeps saying this in chapter 8, chapter 9, and now again in chapter 10, he tells his disciples that he's going to die. He needs them to know what kind of a Messiah he's going to be. Let me read from verse 32. "And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid." Can you feel the tension? Nobody dares speak. They're following behind Jesus, anxiously waiting to see what he does next. And he takes the 12, he was probably being followed by a great crowd of believers, and now he just takes the 12 apostles and tells them what's going to happen. He says, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles." Well, that's new. It's going to be in Jerusalem, is it? As in where we're going now? Jesus, if you know you're going to get killed there, let's turn around, let's go the other way. And it's also a pretty humiliating death by the sound of things. He'll be handed over not just to the Jewish authorities, but to foreigners, Gentiles, The Messiah, the one who will save the Jews, is going to be murdered at the hands of the enemies of the Jews. How outrageous is that? But note that Jesus says it's not the end. He's also going to rise. He says this each time he predicts his death in this section. It's not all doom and gloom. Jesus is going to rise from the dead into glory. But his death is coming first. And this brings us to James and John, and hopefully now we see how their angle on things is more than a little bit bonkers. If Jesus is going to go through all this suffering, how can those who follow him expect to have an easy ticket into glory? No, and this is our second point. Jesus' followers are going to serve. When James and John come up to Jesus, they latch on to what Jesus says about rising, completely glossing over all the suffering and dying stuff he's talked about before. They say, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left hand in your glory." They're latching on to what Jesus said about rising. James and John have been listening pretty selectively to what Jesus has been saying. "Ah, you're going to rise. That's interesting. What's in it for me?" More than that, they want to get a shortcut to the best seats in the house. They want super special ultra glory right next to Jesus. And Jesus comes right back at them and says, "Were you even listening?" He'd spelled out in great detail all the suffering he was going to experience, and it seems James and John didn't really think that bit was important. They just glossed over it, forgot that he said it. When Jesus asks them, "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptised with the baptism with which I am baptised?" He's using Old Testament imagery to ask them if they're able to participate in the suffering and dying that he's going to go through. And they answer without a second thought. I love this bit. It's just one word in Greek, this "we can." It's the equivalent of them smiling, going, "Mm-hmm, sure." It's so flippant, it's unthinking. And Jesus says, "Yes, you're right, you will suffer." In fact, we saw that this morning in Acts. We saw how James was one of the first people killed for his faith. Jesus says, "You're right, you will suffer." But who gets the special glory? Well, that's not up to me. What a shock to the system this must have been for James and John. And we could get wrapped up in how seating in heaven will work, whether there are seats at Jesus' right and left, who gets them, who decides them. But Jesus doesn't seem to think it's important. He turns the focus away from the future glory. So, forgive me, I don't think we need to spend too much time thinking about it. As interesting as it may be, it's not really that central to the passage. But anyway, here come the other disciples. In they come, ready to give James and John a right royal telling off. "What are you doing asking Jesus for special glory? That's not what he's about. We need to be ready to suffer." That's not really what they say, is it? We don't know for sure what they do say, but I think we can make a fairly good guess it's not that. Let me read verses 41 to 43. "And when the 10 heard about it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus called them to him and said to them, 'You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you.'" This is addressed to all 12 of them, so we can make a rather good guess that their issue with James and John wasn't one of rebuke, but one of jealousy. It sounds like they wanted the special glory just as much as James and John did. And so Jesus' rebuke goes to all of them. "It shall not be so among you. For whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." Now this confused me when I read it first, because at first glance it does look like Jesus is saying, "You should only serve because you want glory. You can grasp and strive after glory, that's okay, but you've got to do it in a subtle, underhand way." And what I found surprising is that Jesus isn't quite saying what we think he is. It does sound like that's what it is, doesn't it? The sort of subtle, secret striving for glory, like tunnelling under glory and coming up the other side. But I think what Jesus is actually doing is quite different, because there's no cause and effect here. We often read this as saying, in order to be great, you must be a servant. But I think what he's actually doing is telling those who follow him to take their desire for greatness and let it go. Let me read that verse again. It shall not be so among you, for whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. He's saying, in the world, the great ones are those who lord it over everyone else. But we don't do that kind of greatness. You want to be great? Well, that's not how we do things here. You need to be a servant. You want to be first? Well, actually, you should be a slave. And this is hard, because I really want to be great. I want to be first. Deep down in all our hearts is that desire. I don't mind saying it's dangerous for me whenever I get up here and preach. There's always the danger that I'm doing it because I want to be great, and I like having the attention. Maybe the same is true for each one of us. When we think about getting a promotion or winning a competition, does our desire for greatness outweigh our willingness to serve? I think for all of us, that desire is really quite hard to overcome. Maybe even in church, we're trying to serve in certain ways to be the centre of attention or to be up the front. Does our desire for greatness outweigh our willingness to serve? So how do we do it? How does Jesus expect us to obey such a difficult command? Well, he doesn't demand of us any more than he himself is ready to give. Last point, Jesus is going to serve. Let's look at the famous verse 45. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. The word there for life is the same as the word in chapter 8. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? That soul word is the same word translated life here, is psuche. What Jesus gave is the very thing that is worth more than the whole world. What can any man give in exchange for his soul? Implication, nothing. It's what you can't give anything in exchange for. And Jesus gave it up. Why? Well, as a ransom. Imagine a crime drama where a criminal demands a ransom. They say, pay this amount or we won't let you have the president back, or something like that. And you pay the price and you get them back. In this culture, it was less about criminals, in the first century Jewish culture, it was less about criminals, but the buying back idea was still there. It was just about slaves, buying slaves back. And Jesus' life, his soul, was the ransom for many. That was the price that needed to be paid to buy us back. Jesus didn't make himself great or put himself first. He humbled himself. He was a servant, a slave. He gave his very soul. And if we truly get that, then we will follow his example. We will gladly be those who are the servants of all. In church, talking to the guest who's a little bit awkward, wiping down the chairs afterwards rather than rushing off to watch the football or get back and do the gardening. And in our day-to-day as well, outside of church, let's go about our interactions with non-Christians with a Christ-like attitude of service and pray that they'll see Jesus through us. Let's love our husbands, wives, children, parents, brothers, sisters, friends, neighbours, with an attitude of humble service. Because that's what Jesus did for us. And one final thing. Let's take our eyes off our own actions for a minute and stand in awe of Jesus. Because we will never be those who serve others unless we first accept his service of us. And as we share in the bread and wine now, let's remember Christ's sacrifice as a ransom for each one of us. As a ransom for Matt, for Mike, for Nicola. Let's look at the cross and see his humility, his amazing, jaw-dropping act of service for us. Whenever we're tempted to be a bit selfish, to grasp for power, be less humble, be less of a servant, friends, let's look to the cross and marvel at how Jesus served us, giving his body and blood that we may be ransomed. And when we've grasped that, we will gladly be those who are the servants of all. Let me pray. Lord, thank you so much that Jesus willingly went to the cross. Thank you that his death fully paid the ransom for us. Thank you for his attitude of service, for how we are freed, we are bought back, redeemed by his blood, by him giving everything. Please help us to wonder at that, to keep coming back to the cross, crying out for your mercy, leaning on you for forgiveness to buy us back. We pray that as we see more of Jesus' humble service, that will flow out into an attitude of humility, of servanthood to everyone around us. In your precious name. Amen.